it's now grounded on its secondary. You see what I'm worried about on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, as he goes up in the higher frequencies, it could cause a problem, but that also could be taken care of. But at least he has a great idea now what to build. He could build a little jig, and he's got himself going. Yeah, I think it would be better if he had even an inexpensive DVMs, because they're cheap and they're pretty accurate today. And, you know, you can pick up something for $30 that works really well. And you're right, that'll be totally isolated. You can do whatever he wants with it. Other than that, he's got to go to differential inputs.
There's two or three ways around this problem, John. One is to first measure the voltage drop across the resistor, then flip the location of resistor and capacitor. So you're always making a voltage measurement with reference to ground and make them equal. That's one approach. The other approach is to first measure the voltage across the resistor, then measure the voltage coming out of the signal generator, both are grounded measurements, and now use the right ratio. When the resistive reactance, when the resistor equals the capacitive reactance, at that instant of time, the voltage that appears across the resistor is equal to the voltage across the capacitor. That's true. The voltage that appears across the resistor is exactly 45 degrees phase leading, phase shifted, compared to the voltage coming out of the signal generator. Knowing that it's exactly 45 degrees of phase shift, you now know exactly what voltage there should be between the resistor and resistor to ground versus signal generator to ground. It's a right triangle, if you know what I mean. One square root of two between the two sides and the hypotenuse. When you're measuring the voltage coming out of the signal generator, it is the hypotenuse of the signal generator, of the triangle, of a 45-90 right triangle. An equilateral right triangle. That's not equilateral. You know what I mean, though. Isosceles right triangle. So, square root of two will be the increase in voltage coming out of the signal generator versus the signal across the resistor. If you measured 1 volt on the resistor and you measured 1.41 volts coming out of the signal generator, then if you had a thoroughly floating voltmeter, like your digital voltmeter, you would measure 1 volt across the resistor and 1 volt across the capacitor. So knowing what happens with 45 degrees of phase shift, when capacitor reactance equals the resistance, you can now make all of the measurements with
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can now make all of the measurements with reference to ground. The next level beyond that is maybe your signal generator has got some kind of a built-in calibrator where it can put out exactly 1 KC or exactly 100 KC, measuring the ratio of the voltage coming out of the signal generator versus the resistor voltage and applying the right formula. Once you understand this phase shift phenomenon, is another way of doing it without a floating voltmeter. So you'd be amazed how many people I've told them that they can easily measure the capacitance to a couple of percent accuracy by putting it across any kind of a signal generator with a known resistor in series and measure a voltage drop across the resistor versus signal generator. I've told a whole lot of hams about that over the years, and their eyes glass over and they say, I don't want to do that. And I was a little bit disappointed by that. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, I'm surprised to hear that too, Dick, because most of us hams like to do things simply and cheaply. And some of these exotic capacitance devices, testing device, are very expensive, but this is a system he will definitely be able to tell whether it's within 10% of its tolerance, and that will keep him out of trouble. So I think that's a great idea for him. And of course he'll have to apply himself and learn how to do it, but it's not hard, and he should be able to pick it up real quick. One or two experiments should put him right in line. KC2WGB. Thank you, Dick.
Yeah, but this technique now will work beautifully for AC electrolytic capacitors, AC rated electrolytic capacitors, and normal fixed capacitors made out of mica and mylar and whatever. when it comes to your polarized capacitors, you've now got a bit of a problem. If you had a 10 microfarad electrolytic capacitor, where you're never supposed to put a negative voltage on the positive lead of that capacitor, and the amount of capacitance it displays is a little bit a function of the voltage you apply. Maybe you could make the circuit work at a small enough voltage, like half a volt, and it'd be no problem. But if you wanted to confirm that a 10 microfarad electrolytic capacitor has 10 microfarads, and if it's not an AC rated capacitor, if it's a normal DC electrolytic capacitor, the circuit could give you some troubles. Yeah, there's various ways that you could put a battery with a high resistance into the capacitor, making sure the capacitor is positively charged, make sure your AC voltmeter is AC coupled, and now you can get around that. So there's various ways that you can measure the capacitance of a electrolytic capacitor while DC voltage is being applied to it. There's various ways you could do that, but you got to be a little bit careful with polarized capacitors. Wonder if that makes some sense, John. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. And he was talking about non-polarized caps. So he was talking about the general type of cap. So nothing really super special, but he should be able to read quite a range with the circuit you designed. And I think he's going to have a lot of fun with that. Yeah, electrolytics, especially the blue boys, when you get up to 8,000 and 20,000 mics, they're not that easy to test, Dick.
If you're smart enough, I say they are, John. If I had to measure a 20,000 microfarad capacitor, and if I had an AC signal generator that went down to, let me pick a number, 10 hertz, and if I'm willing to put that into, let me pick a number, a 50-ohm resistor, I could easily confirm its microfarads. If I kept the voltage level low enough, the fact that it's polarized probably wouldn't give me any grief. If I'm willing to use a battery and a high resistor to put voltage onto the capacitor and make the signal generator and the voltmeter AC coupled, now I could measure it under real conditions. I could also, if I'm trying to test a whole lot of these 20,000 microfarad capacitors, I could put a pair of them back to back, two capacitors of 20,000 mics each, back to back, plus to plus, in series, would now give you 10,000 microfarads, and I could confirm it that way. But just biasing the capacitor with a high value resistor using a 1.5 volt flashlight battery, and the AC coupled the signal generator and AC coupled the voltmeter, I could now measure it under working conditions. So even 20,000 microfarads, a low enough frequency is going to give it a lot of capacitive reactance. A low enough sensing resistor is going to allow you to see a very small capacitive reactance. If I go in the other direction, if I'm willing to make the signal generator go up to a megacycle, and if I'm willing to use a 10,000 ohm load resistor, I think I could easily confirm a 10 picofarad, maybe even a 1 picofarad, very, very small capacitor. Make the frequency high enough, make the resistor high enough, and I could confirm by all these combinations, I think I could make measurements of everything from one
repeater, timeout, cancel.
By changing the frequencies and the load resistors, I think I could confirm everything from 1 picofarad up to 100,000 microfarads. Just have to freewheel the thinking a little bit and let the numbers change on frequency and load resistor, John. KC2WGB. Don't let that stop you. K2RIW on the deck, man.
Well, the problem is, you go up in the high frequencies. Well, for me, it's no problem. I have a lot of these RF voltmeters. A lot of guys don't. So when you really get up in frequency, you're dealing with 10 picofarads. It's not that easy without the equipment.
Well, maybe your voltmeter now becomes an oscilloscope, John. By properly calibrating your oscilloscope, and the oscilloscope probe has got a I think the input impedance of a good oscilloscope probe is something like a megohm shunted by 7 picofarads. So with a little bit of smarts, looking at the data sheet for your scope probe, your voltmeter now becomes an oscilloscope. And if you're really one of these lucky guys that's got a dual channel oscilloscope, where you can use the A minus B function, where the probes essentially float, now you don't even have the grounded probe problem. You've got to worry about the oscilloscope, meaning that the negative lead on the probe of the oscilloscope, in many cases, is grounded to the case of the oscilloscope. And so it's not a floating voltmeter. Well, with the A minus B function of a dual channel oscilloscope with two probes, you can now make some thoroughly floating measurements, and depending on the maximum frequency range of your oscilloscope, you could probably go to a couple of hundred megacycles. Under those conditions, I think I could confirm a 0.1 picofarad capacitor, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
KC2WGB. Absolutely, Dick. And if you had a differential input plug-in, you could do it a lot easier. But yes, you can. In fact, I use my oscilloscope in place of a meter on most applications because it's right there on the bench and just switching a couple of buttons and I can make it do whatever I want. Bringing out the meter sometimes, not that it's not that convenient.
Let's see if Paul is still with us. WS2N. Paul, are you there? K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, still here, Dick. Watching the storm go through. I think the one that just went past you is coming my way. How you doing?
I'm looking out my eastern window, and I'm seeing some bright flashes on the horizon to the east. So it must be getting to you out there in Ronkonkoma. So what has, you sound good. What has National Aeronautics and Space Administration been doing this week? I presume Curiosity is on the way to Mars. I think I read a report somewhere that somebody's worried about whether or not the heat shield is going to properly disconnect on Curiosity. When it does its Mars atmospheric encounter, descent, and landing, that very violent couple of minutes of time, boy, all of those squibs have to fire at just the right time. All those rockets have got to go on just the right time. The grain's got to drop down. The cable's got to be cut on the crane. Boy, there's a million things that got to go just right. I guarantee that's going to be a nail-biter. On top of that, it gives you a funny feeling while you're watching all of your instrumentation at Pasadena, California, where the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is located. They've got to recognize the fact that everything they're watching and all their screens, because of the distance between them and Mars is going to be, oh, let me pick a number, 150 or 200 million miles, there's going to be something like 16 minutes of time delay at the speed of light. Everything they watch on their screen of this three-minute event is already 15 minutes old news, if you know what I mean. In other words, once they see the picture on Mars of when it lands, that picture will already be 16 minutes or something like that old because of the time delay. And there's no chance of them to fire up another command and say, hey, change this. It's too late. WS2N, K2RAW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, it's weird if you look at the orbits, too. The Earth is way ahead of Mars right now. You know, it looks like about 30 degrees. You know, in reference to the using the sun as like a focal point, about 25, maybe 30 degrees ahead of Mars when that thing lands. So, I was looking at it. I thought maybe the planning would be to have it closer to us when they started transmitting. But it really doesn't matter for the extra few minutes. But it had to do with the arc and the travel of where Earth was and where Mars will be when they try to make that the shortest distance. So, if you look at the, where's Curiosity now, if you can find one of those sites, they show you that. It looks like Earth is way ahead. In another month or two, Earth is going to be way ahead of Mars. So, before you know it, it'll be the whole, 200 million miles they'll be almost opposite the sun in probably about 3 or 4 months. But yeah, that will land in August. Let me drop it. So we'll be doing a net, and I'll be thinking about this thing landing. It won't be like Sunday night. It'll actually be Monday morning at 1:31 Eastern Standard Time. The time that they give is Pacific Standard Time. That's what you see on the when you look it up. 10:31 Pacific Standard Time. That makes it 1:31 here. So we'll be ending it in that. Maybe we get the repeater to stay open for another hour. So no, just kidding. They do that for us. They'll have to do it for everybody. But that's going to be that Sunday night. It's about 30 days away now. So they shortened the landing footprint, the ellipse that they were going to land in. It's about half of what it was. It's only about 4 miles by 12 miles now. It'd just be a lot bigger. The accuracy is increasing as they go. Drop it. Haven't heard about the heat shield problem. I'm sure they worry about it, you know. But here this gigantic parachute is going to open up. I think it's got to hold 60,000 pounds per square inch. And only the parachute only weighs 100 pounds. So it's the biggest one they've made. Slow this thing down. It does weigh 2 tons. Oh, okay. On Mars, it will weigh 700 pounds, but you know, it's a heavy thing. You wouldn't be able to lift it up if you were standing on Mars on one end. So, you know, over 700 pounds is a big number. But 2,000 pounds on Earth, it's like a small car. So we'll be looking forward to that. It's got a lot of things have to happen. I know we go through this quite a bit. Let me drop it. Those who don't know, this thing's coming through at 13,000 miles per hour. Compared to a lunar flight, if you were bringing something back from the moon or from Mars to Earth, it would be 25,000 miles per hour on Earth. But 13,000 is pretty fast. Mars has a rarefied atmosphere. I think it's something like 0.04% of what we have, but it's enough to heat up that heat shield to 1,300 degrees, maybe 1,400 degrees. Then they have to separate that heat shield, and once they do that, then they can see the ground. You know, that's covering up the system of radar that's going to be looking at the ground. Now a radar can see the ground and can actually take pictures on the way down. Then they have to drop from the back shell. And now what you have is a falling rover and a falling back shell with rockets on it. The rocket's going to fire, trying to, you know, slow itself even down more. And here's this crane. The crane is going to drop this rover. It's going to dangle about 100 feet below it. The rockets are angled at a 45 WS2M for the space net. And as it gets about to touch, before it drops from the crane itself, it actually has to maneuver out of the way of the parachute and the back shell. So it's actually going to, you know, the rocket's going to fire, but it's actually going to go put it on an angle, and it's going to drift further away to make sure it doesn't get caught up in the parachute. And then it's going to come down vertically, lower the rover on a cable, and then the second the rover hits the ground, cable's going to break. There's also data cables involved. There's power cables. There's all kinds of cables that have to separate. And then this guy crane, still firing its rockets, will take off and leave the area. And the rubble will be on the ground. And the idea of the rockets on an angle, too, they don't want to fry the spacecraft. They can't have the rockets looking down. So there is eight rockets looking almost like on 45 degrees, but maybe 30 degrees away from dead center. So good luck to them. In about a month, let me drop it. And just wanted to cover that. No, also, we have another crew that went up to the space station. They launched on the 14th yesterday from Kazakhstan on a Soyuz spacecraft. Three people. They're all hams, by the way. So one Russian, one Japanese, and Sunita Williams. She's been up two times before. Done a lot of spacewalks. She's got the record for a woman as far as spacewalks. So they'll be on station, bring the crew back up to six. And that's pretty much it. I didn't have that much with tonight, Dick. At the end, I just wanted to give you an answer about the Coast Guard. That was Stephen that brought that up last week. I do have a pretty good answer from a club in Connecticut. This is WS2N.
Yeah, Paul, I got a quick question. This solar storm we're having right now, how is that affecting the astronauts on the way up to the space station?
They don't really have much of a problem in low Earth orbit. Although, you know, in general, they're getting more radiation than everybody on Earth just by being up there. In fact, pilots are getting radiated every day, but more so on a space station. But that's why you're at low Earth orbit. Originally, you know, you think back to 2001 Space Odyssey. They wanted to have the space station. You know, they had them looking down. It looked like it was not geosynchronous, but I would say it looked like it was about halfway between the two, maybe 11,000 miles. Not a good spot to put the space station due to the Van Allen belts. Then they would have a problem. They'd have a problem on a regular basis, never mind with one of these storms. So I think they're relatively safe at that height. Some of the satellites, they have the capability of shutting things down. You could fry the electronics, but the people themselves, I've never heard that there's a big problem. If you're on the way to Mars, you know, then there would be a problem. They might go into the equivalent of a storm shelter. Let me drop it.
Paul, weren't there a couple of occasions in the past when the sun did spit out a very large coronal mass ejection, CME, and weren't the astronauts on the International Space Station told to, for the next hour or so, go into the high-density portion of the spacecraft and dwell there so there's the maximum amount of shielding material between them and the sun? Haven't there been a couple of events like that, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW?
I remember that on Mir, but not on it might have been. It rings a bell, but no, Mir was not as protected as the space station. Actually, the biggest problem is secondary rays. When the cosmic rays hit anything on the outside, they have secondary rays that come off of it, you know, and those that are, they could cause problems. I remember the astronauts going to the moon. In a couple of cases, they had that problem. They see like little things going by in their eye, you know, flashes. And after a while, they determined that's what it was, secondary rays coming from the sun.
Well, I've heard it differently. Almost every one of the astronauts, at nighttime, when their eyes are dark adapted, and they close their eyes, and they're in a dark room, they will see flashes of light periodically. It's called Cherenkov radiation, or Cherenkov radiation, named after a Russian scientist, and it really means that a cosmic ray came along, went through the side of the spacecraft, went right through the guy's eye, went roaring out the other side, and left a streak of light in the process. So ordinary cosmic rays, when you're above the atmosphere, I think, give you these flashes of light that every one of the astronauts have seen from time to time, to my knowledge, at nighttime when their eyes are dark adapted. So you're saying that the International Space Station is made out of such solid stuff, it has so much shielding, that to your knowledge there were no incidents where they were told to go to a massive section of the spacecraft during a CME event. Is that true, Paul? You think only Mir had to do that? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, as I remember, I don't recall that with the International Space Station at all. Yeah, I mean, it might have happened. It might have happened a couple of times. I might have missed it. I heard it was secondary radiation that is what they're seeing. So you're saying you're actually seeing the cosmic rays. I'm just going back, reading about the Apollo missions in particular, and I believe they said it was secondary. You know, you'd hit the outer shell and then it would spin off from that, and that was actually what they were seeing. Don't remember exactly, though. Don't want to write that one down in stone, but good thing to look into. Get off track. I was on another topic before, but I went astray, Dick. Don't recall what I was going to say. Something about the probably the space station. Oh, I know what it was. On flights to Mars, they have plans on, you know, there's going to be water on board, plenty of water. You know that we've discussed that. You're going to need like half of Lake Ronkonkoma to go to Mars. But they're going to be in gigantic bags, and they'll set them around one particular room. Water is a good insulator against these cosmic rays, either direct or secondary, I guess. But that's what they want to do. In other words, you're going to have one room that's going to be surrounded with walls of water that they're going to be drinking anyway. And that's going to be their storm shelter. That's what I wanted to say back to you.
In a minute, I'm going to be asking Barry, N2MB, with this CME that we just got over the weekend, which was supposed to hit us on Saturday morning, whether or not he's heard some extra or 6-meter activity. He's well equipped on 6 meters. I'll be getting over to you in a minute on that one, Barry. But right now, one other thing I wanted to mention, Paul, and that is these bags of water that will be with the astronauts that go to Mars. Great-sounding theory. But you know my feeling on that one. I think the chances of your grandchildren being an American astronaut or any kind of foreign astronaut on Mars, I think is very unlikely. I did a quick calculation over the last few days, and that is an average human being takes around 10 breaths per minute, and each breath has an approximate volume of 1 liter of air. And so you can easily calculate how many liters of air go into your lungs and come back out of your lungs per hour, per day, per year. And the bottom line is if you weigh the amount of air that goes into your lungs and out of your lungs per year, it's 14,000 pounds of air. 7 tons of air goes into your lungs. Another 7 tons of air comes back out of your lungs per year. And it won't take you very long to calculate what's the volume of 7 tons of air. That's just air. And you add to that the water and the food, all of that, all of those molecules of air go into your body, and almost every one of them comes back out. All those molecules of water go into your body, almost every one of them comes back out. All those molecules of food go into your body, and one way or another, they come back out. There's a lot of continuous flow of material. As I've said so many times, the weight of your house and the volume of your house is the approximate ratio of the stuff.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's what it takes to maintain you for a year. So to pack that much on a spacecraft for 3 astronauts for 3-year mission to Mars and back, very unlikely. You're going to have to recycle every single molecule of gas, liquid, and solid that goes through a human being. Without recycling it, there's just no way you can supply that amount of food. I mean, the number of intermediate stations you'd have to have all along the way to refuel air, fuel, and water. It's just out of sight. So I think it's not going to happen. And there's no reason for it to happen. To send Curiosity to do all these zillions of experiments for the next year or two on Mars is a beautiful thing to do. To send a human being there, to put him in the middle of that extremely cold, extremely dry, extremely airless desert. There's just no reason to spend, let me pick a number, $300 million is what I think it would take to do it, to send a man to Mars, and the chances of getting him back alive are very slim. So I just don't think it's going to happen. I'm back to you for any comments on that one, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW.
Well, the cost sounds about right. It was $30 billion for Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo to get people to the moon. Then they had a little extra left over, and a lot of momentum, and that went into Voyager and a lot of the missions to Mars, the Viking missions that landed on Mars in the late 70s. 1976, July 20th, was a Viking mission. And then that thing operated for 6 years. 6 years. The orbit is, you know, everybody thinks of the Viking mission that landed on Mars. They had, each one had an orbiter. And each orbiter functioned about 8 years without failing. And then finally they ran low on fuel. And people said, well, what happened to them? You know, they didn't make the moons or Mars, so. They fired the jets, went from a couple hundred miles up, like, I don't know, I think it's like 20,000 miles up. It's planned that these things are going to last up there, and they won't even start to come down until I think it was 2019, close to 2020. And that was years ago when they did it. So that's the orbiters. Very good. A lot of money went into those missions because they had a lot left. A lot of money in the space program back then. Let me drop it. But now, to send somebody to Mars, yep, $300 billion wouldn't be, probably wouldn't be too far off. Now you've got private companies, they're interested in going to the moon. You've got the Google Prize, like the Ansani Prize. You know, the Ansani Prize was the couple million dollars just to fund the private space venture. Try to get somebody to go up suborbital, come down 2 weeks later, do the same thing. Well, they did that. Rutan did that a couple years ago. But now they got the new prize. Google put the money up. Now, if you could do this before 2015, you're going to get $20 million. You got to send a rocket unmanned and have a lander land on the moon. Go 1,500 feet, they use meters, they call it, you know, 500 meters. Go 1,500 meters, sending data back, and you don't have to bring nothing back, and you're going to get $20 million. So, and it's that same company that's really pushing for it, I forgot the name of it, wants to eventually send people to the moon. So this is the way we're going. We're going to commercial.
Is that moon operation another Ansari prize? Ansari, I think it was, that funded the first couple of competitions. The first manned flight that flies a kilometer, or was it a mile, round trip, man-powered airplane. And then I guess it was the first airplane that flew by electric power, was it, over the English Channel or something like that. And I forgot what this last prize is you talked to me about, the one before the moon. I back you, Paul. Yeah, it was space.
The prize. That was for the flight around the Earth without without refueling in an airplane. That was Bert Rutan and the wife at the time. They did that. Two of them. They were like laying down, you know, could barely fit in this thing. I think it took 20 hours or something like that to go all the way around the Earth. Well, that same guy, he's the one that's involved with developing these spaceships that will take people to, well, in the beginning, suborbital. And he had that Spaceship One that made it to suborbital. Then they had another pilot, and he did the same thing within 2 weeks. So he got the money, a couple $1 million for that, $10 million or something. And now that was the Ansari prize. But now this is by Google. Let me drop it. It's been offered for quite a while, so there's some 25 different teams that are competing, trying to do this, and there's a couple of them that are pretty far along, but I haven't followed it that much, but that's the goal, and you got to do it before, you know, the deal is off after 2015, so, and I think this is second prize, too, $5 million or something. Very interesting, but that'll be the way to go. Yeah, as far as the Mars mission, well, it don't have to be Mars. Maybe they'll do the asteroids. They seem bent on doing these asteroids. I don't get it, but that's what they want to do. But you still have to go out just as far, actually further, to get to the asteroid belt with these Orion spacecraft, and you'd have to have, you know, you're gonna have the same problem with the supplies there. You need a Biosphere 3. You know, you had Biosphere 1, that's Earth. Biosphere 2, that's the one that lived in, they lived for a couple of years in Arizona. And a bunch of people stayed in that thing. And then, we're going to call this Biosphere 3. If we can get to an asteroid back with no additional supplies.
Yeah, that Biosphere experiment wasn't as successful as it was supposed to be. They were losing weight. By the way, Bert Rutan, when he flew Voyager in 1986 around the world with one supply of fuel, he flew with a lady named Gianna Yeager. Gianna Yeager was not his wife. Might have been his girlfriend at the time, but not his wife. And after that flight, they didn't want to see each other anymore. They had lived through hell for the... I forget how many days it took for that particular flight. Let's see if Barry is available. Barry, did we have any 6-meter openings because of this aurora? And did anybody have a clear enough sky to see the aurora this weekend that was supposed to take place because of that great big CME? N2MB, if you're available, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. That aurora is still going on. It's very intense as we speak. It's been 2 days now. And yes, I made a number of contacts, I think about 15, and not using much power. On sideband, by the way, on 6 meters, I made about 15 contacts, and that's with about 100 watts. About 100 watts, and a good antenna, but only 100 watts, and with sideband, but 6 meters. So 6 meters was very good for aurora. 2 meters, I heard precious little activity, and I don't know why. I think it's just the sign of the times. I think the enthusiasm isn't as great as it was many, many years ago when I used to do this a lot. But, yeah, a lot of contacts were made, and conditions were good, and they still are. And I suspect they might be tomorrow morning. I can't go on at this time of night because the streetlights make too much noise and I can't hear anything. But usually those auroras are better at night, you know. So I'm just sitting here twiddling my thumbs waiting for the dawn. K2RIW N2MB.
I know you've got a great big long Yagi on the top of your tower now, which is 52 feet long or something like that on the boom. And I keep forgetting, is that on 6 meters or is it on 2 meters? But with that antenna, are you able to steer to the so-called hotspot of the aurora curtain? When I would occasionally hear aurora signals on 432, back in the days when I had my 16 Yagi array, 304 total elements on 100 feet of tower, a 5.5-degree beamwidth antenna, I would see the hotspot move around per 10 or 20 minutes, so to speak. The hotspot of the aurora curtain would move around, give me different amounts of Doppler shift. I wonder if you've seen anything like that on either your 6 or your 2-meter great big long Yagi. And what kind of DX have you been hearing on these aurora QSOs you've been making, Barry? N2MB, K2RIW.
Okay, well, I'm hearing, of course, a lot of Canada, Nova Scotia, stuff like Iowa. I heard them. I didn't hear much to the south of me. I think there were stations on. There are stations on, I should say. There were. They're still doing it to the south of me. Mostly all on 6. My big antenna is on 6 meters. And, I was thinking about that. I am able to steer around and get a good spot. But in the days when I had the big 2-meter array and the big 432 array, I was able to notice that the aurora also changed in elevation. I don't notice that, and I have no way to test it, but I suspect it. I would like to put a test by weather thing. We have terrible weather here tonight. We had an absolutely horrendous... come on, wait a minute, let's go. Oh, boy. Okay. Yeah, we had a tremendous thunderstorm coming through here during the net tonight. That was a little confusing. Anyway, let me just drop it for a second. Okay. Yeah, in the past, I would be able to see changes in elevation of the aurora. I can't do that now, but I very clearly remember working people on sideband on 2 meters, and that wasn't good. I listened tonight and heard no activity on 2, and even less on 432. That's what I was saying. The enthusiasm isn't like it used to be. That's unfortunate because those bands do support aurora. Certainly 2 meters, they definitely support aurora. But nobody's trying. K2RIW and 2MB and the net.
Wow. Got to be some CW and moonbounds type people on 2 meters that would recognize an aurora if they heard one. So you heard no aurora activity. Aren't there any websites where people report what they're hearing along those lines? And so the hotspots you haven't heard, you haven't sensed the hotspot moving around, you haven't seen Doppler shift. On 432, I could hear definitely Doppler shift on the left side versus the right side of the aurora curtain. On 6 meters, I don't think you're going to hear that. And even if you could tilt that antenna, I don't think you're going to see any difference in elevation. I'm guessing your antenna has got, about a 10 or 12 degree beamwidth to it. Barry, go ahead.
I think it's about 10 degrees, right? The other thing that I was able to hear, probably because of the lower frequency, I used to hear a kind of a gurgling sound when I pointed the antennas into the aurora, and I could actually peek up on the gurgling sound. I was able to do that on 6. I tried it on 2, but my antenna is not good enough on 2 to hear that.
Are there any websites where people would be reporting 2-meter aurora QSOs if they had any? Barry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to bring that up to you because I don't remember the name of it. One second, I'll give it to you. Hold on a second. All right, come on. Okay. Okay. There's one called, it's a long name, QSO/SWL Real Time Maps. That one, if I brought that up, it's going to give me a big, long, a huge VHFDX info is where you would get started on that. And that one has plenty of information on the aurora, and there's one more. Hold a second. Hang on. Okay. Let me see here. SK6AW.net with a whole bunch of stuff after it is also a very good place. And that right now, I'm looking at it right now, and there are guys reporting 6-meter contacts on aurora as we speak.
But nobody on any of those websites is reporting any 2-meter aurora. Is it because the aurora curtain was not intense enough to get up to 2 meters?
I seriously doubt that. I think it's just that there's lack of activity or enthusiasm. Let me go. I'm going to 2. I'm looking at 2. Looking at 2. And, here's one. Okay, there's somebody at 0215 reported a contact. And this is all European. This is a guy.
Okay, one other thing I was going to mention to you guys is that Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y, brought to my attention but there was a short notice given about a commemorative transmission that took place this weekend. Mr. Edwin H. Armstrong, some people call him the inventor of FM radio, FM broadcast, FM transmission techniques. He's the guy who set up this 425-foot high tower with the three arms to it in Alpine, New Jersey.
Still there.
It sure is. And there's a whole bunch of enthusiastic guys who have reestablished the original transmitter techniques with a phasotron, I think it's called, FM modulator that runs on a crystal oscillator. And they made a transmission at 11 o'clock in the morning yesterday, Saturday, and it went on for quite a few hours on 42.8 megacycles. That was the original frequency that Edward Armstrong was given by the FCC to do his FM broadcasting from that exact same tower way back in the middle 40s, I guess it was, or early 40s. And so this enthusiastic group of guys set up a 200-watt transmitter on top of that tower, vertically polarized, and transmitted signals. And Joe W2RYY and Dick K2RIW listened to them, and we sent to their email site. If you just simply Google Whiskey Alpha 2 X-ray Mic November, Whiskey Alpha 2 X-ray Mic November, that was the original experimental license that was given to Edward Armstrong. This enthusiastic group of guys have gotten that license reestablished with a special temporary authority, and they're good up until 2015. So from time to time, they make transmissions, and their last transmission was they rebroadcast the radio program called Empire of the Air, which describes Armstrong and I can't think of the other guy's name from RCA. You know who I'm talking about.
David Sarnoff.
That's the one, David Sarnoff. So the story about the way they fought each other for year after year and spent fortunes fighting their lawsuits over who really was the inventor of FM and who should be given exclusive rights of using it and so on. But anyhow, that program was rebroadcast starting at 11. They were supposed to go on the air at 11 o'clock, and somewhere around 11:20 or so they were putting on carrier. At actual 11:40, 20 minutes to 12, I think it was, is when they actually started the broadcast. And so these are ham radio-like guys, but it's really a broadcast on 42.8 meg. So you'd have to use a scanner or an old-fashioned FM receiver. That's where the FM band used to be. So I wonder if anyone else within the sound of my voice knew about this broadcast. And as I said, if you Google the word WA2XMN, you'll find out an awful lot of information.
How did you find out about it?
KC2QIQ with a question?
Yeah, W2RYY found out about it because somebody at his place of business brought it to his attention. And there is an email, there's a website describing it. KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn. What would you like to know about this?
If you could just fit me in sometime at the end, Dick, there's something I just want to bring up with you again about the spaceship trip to Mars, but I don't want to break in the middle now. KC2QIQ listening.
Yeah, okay, so that's how I found out about it. It's not very well advertised. Once you know about the websites that give you this information, by Googling WA2XMN, that experimental license, and it certainly sounds like a ham radio call letters, but you go to QSL.net or QSL.com, whichever it is, and you put in WA2XMN, they'll tell you that license doesn't exist. Well, it does exist. It's issued to these guys in New Jersey. And you can find out about this phasotron, a kind of modulator. The way broadcasts used to be done is that they would start off with a very low crystal, phase modulate that signal, and you'd have to multiply a zillion times, 190 times or 200 and some odd times frequency multiplication. And in order to get broadcast standard plus or minus 75 kilohertz of FM deviation, and when you're doing it with phase modulation, it gets more and more difficult as you go down in frequency. So get down to 50 hertz to have good hi-fi FM and to have enough phase modulation, plus or minus 75 kilohertz of it, you've got to be using an extremely high multiplication ratio if you aren't using some of these other more exotic techniques. Nowadays, there is something invented that you can do digitally called Severodyne modulation, which was first invented with traveling wave tubes. Glenn, go ahead with your quick question, because we've got to real soon go over to Wesley. He wants to talk about slow wave structures. KC2QIQ, K2RW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I was listening to what you were saying before about the the length and the possibility of carrying all the volume up to Mars. And I was just wondering, what was the length of time that they were anticipating? I think it was 5 years.
It takes you close to a year to go from Earth to Mars. In order for waiting for Mars and Earth to be in the proper alignment in order to launch back home, you're going to be on Mars' surface something like a year, and then a little bit less than a year to come back home. So the minimum mission is in the vicinity of 3 years or longer. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, just using those numbers, let's say, or even just 5 years, if the trip were to take a five-year round trip, and we were using the Apollo mission as a guide, which was 10 days, and we look at the size of an Apollo spacecraft, and then, just running a little bit of math here on this one, and just calculating volumes and sizes, what's happening is that the size of the of basic volume would be 200 times the volume of, of typically what Apollo was taking up there. But then you say to yourself, well, if it's 200 times the volume of a single 10-day Apollo mission to do 5 years, would the ship be 200 times larger? And really what happens is that there's a cube root function in this one. And basically what it's saying is that the ship would probably be something more reasonably in the area between 7 to 10 times larger in overall size. But because you have a cube root function, you could fit almost 200 times the volume inside of something, say, 7 times larger. So it's it doesn't necessarily sound like it's completely not feasible, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
In answer to your other question, I don't want to interrupt you guys, but on 2 meters now, after the sun went down, which is I should have been checking, there has been a load of contacts on Aurora on 2. So, yeah, there's activity up. I don't know why I'm not hearing it.
Could be a function of your local noise. And by the way, real good noise blankers can take out an awful lot of ignition noise. The Drake R4C or some of the Kenwood receivers have a real good noise blanker. But I guess the problem was that in your vicinity, you probably have a million fluorescent lights and they all fire at slightly different times. So to have a noise blanker blank that often per second, I guess, is out of the question. Have you tried some of the super good noise blankers, Barry? Does it make any improvement? N2MB, K2LAW?
Actually sodium vapor street lights. I think that's what they are. And they're everywhere. They're all around me. And the blanker has absolutely no effect on them. So as soon as the sun comes up, I'm good.
So you're saying the noise blanker cannot handle... That's too bad. Your noise blanker cannot handle those millions of sodium mercury vapor or whatever, sodium vapor, because they're all firing at a slightly different portion of the peak of the sine wave. So they're not all firing in phase. Is that the problem, Barry?
Yeah, it sounds like white noise, and it has no effect on it. Well, gray noise,
Barry, if you look at the noise on an oscilloscope, and the oscilloscope is synchronized to the 60-cycle line, are there specific portions of the waveform where the noise congregates, or because you've got various lights on all three phases, does it sort of become one great big smear? Have you ever looked at the noise on an oscilloscope synchronized to the 60-cycle line? Back to you, Barry.
No, I've never done that. I only have a spectrum analyzer, and I can't resolve it like that. The spectrum analyzer, the sweep is too slow to see what's going on.
If the majority of your noise was all on phase A as opposed to phase B and phase C simultaneously, which means it's grouped in particular periods of time, and your hearing would hear sort of a 60-cycle component, you could build a kind of a blanker circuit that at least listens to the 50% of the time when the noise is not there, if you know what I mean. Yeah, the audio is going to be kind of rough sounding, and the Morse code is going to be kind of rough sounding, but if you blanked at the right time when the noise is there, if it's only one phase of the mercury vapor or sodium vapor lights. There may be another solution there, Barry. I think you should look at that noise waveform on an oscilloscope synchronized to the 60-cycle line. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, but you do have to consider the fact that it's probably coming from over 100 lights, and they're in a 360-degree circle from me, so it's really a tough call, Dick.
If all of those hundreds of lights are all on one phase, and they're all within a couple of miles of you, that's only a few microseconds of delay, if you know what I mean, and the 60-cycle line is 16 and two-thirds milliseconds per cycle. So if the firing of the lights is at a very particular phase angle of the 60-cycle line, I think there's enough dead time in between that you could use if you had a sophisticated Blanker circuit synchronized to the 60-cycle line. Whether or not that's possible, you'll find out real fast by looking on an oscilloscope. Do you have an oscilloscope where you could look at your audio output and synchronize it to a 60-cycle line? Just talk over this noise there, Barry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a dual-trace scope, so in fact, I will do it. I don't know. Well, it doesn't matter. I could look at it through the output of the receiver. I don't know if my particular scope goes to 2 meters, but it's pretty old. But I am going to try it. I'm going to put the scope on the table here and take a look at it. I never thought about it.
Yeah, looking at the audio output from your receiver on one or two channels of the oscilloscope, and then internally synchronize the oscilloscope two lines, the 60-cycle lines, I think you're going to see the peaking on very specific portions if it's one phase. If the darn lights happen to be, some of the lights are on phase A, some of them on phase B, some of them on phase C, I think the whole idea is going to go down the tubes. But if all of the lights that are giving you the majority of the grief are on one phase, and are these the sodium vapor lights that are alongside of the Southern State Parkway or a Belt Parkway? Are those the bad ones, Barry? Go ahead.
Well, they're along Beach Channel Drive, Rockaway Beach Boulevard, and my own street. You know, they're literally all around me.
Yeah, I'm kind of worried. By the time we add that many lights, they're going to be on all three phases. Oh, well. There's still a slim possibility that there's some milliseconds of time in between the firing where there's quiet periods. And if those quiet periods are just a small number of firings where a real good noise blanker in a receiver could handle it, I think you stand a chance. Back to you, Barry, K2RIW.
Okay, well, one thing I noticed, I have two receivers with kind of different noise blankers in them. I have a 756, which only goes to 6 meters, and I've got this 7000, which goes to 432. I don't know why, but the 7000, the noise blanker, works a hell of a lot better than the 756. I don't even know why, but I'll certainly try this experiment with the 7000, which you could make lots of adjustments to the noise blanker.
Yeah, back in the days when I was doing this experiment, the Drake R4C receiver, that noise blanker, my goodness. You've heard me say it so many times. The Montauk Point radar could be 120 decibels above my noise. I could disconnect the antenna on the 432 converter, and the amount of radar pulses I would pick up in my shack down at ground level coming through the power supply wiring to that 432 converter would allow me to hear the burst of that radar when the main bang went by my house. When it was that strong, with my antenna aimed directly at the radar, 120 dB above my noise, and I turned on that noise blanker, I could hear a weak CW tone, Morse code signal, off the back lobes of the antenna, and all noise of the radar absolutely disappeared. Boy, was that a noise blanker. So there are noise blankers, and there are noise blankers, Barry. They have very different quality factors. Okay, this noise is getting louder and louder. We may have to switch over to 975-375 to get around it. Let's give a quick transmission of see if Wes can get by this jazz. N2XJN, let's see if we can hear you over this, Wes. K2LIW.
N2XJN, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now. I think he's going to be getting louder as time goes on, but even if you start fading out, I'm going to give you my little speech on the subject of slow wave structures. There's three or four kinds of slow wave structures with various kinds of characteristics, so I'll give my little speech on that, but I think that's the main subject you wanted to discuss tonight. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Yeah, I have sent you four parts of it, a very short one. So we can go over that, even with my involvement. One of the things that I'm interested with is the separation of the electric field that does not penetrate into the silicon that's described in my email, which tries to short it out, but the magnetic field does, and that the separation of the electrical and magnetic energy slows the wave propagation. But I'm trying to really understand that the slowing phenomena. The second part, let me drop. The second part of that is very, very quick. I have one picture of the transformer, and then I'm asking mostly Glenn, what is that coil on it? Then I have part number three. Part number three has a horn antenna that works from 700 megahertz to 2 gigahertz, but actually could work from 200 megahertz. And the question for it is, how can I tune it down to 144 megahertz for the directivity? And the part number four is simply interesting for Glenn because of the weight of measure directed in charges in dielectrics and also by different techniques like a pressure wave, which is interesting from the logical point of view. Back to you.
I'm seeing something here called charge detection methods for dielectrics, an overview. Now, the separation of the E field and the H field as a method of operating a slow wave structure, that's a new one on me. But let me first give a quick description of what I think is a slow wave structure. And there's two or three different kinds of slow wave structure. I may have to switch over to the other frequency as this guy gets louder. The first slow wave structure that a lot of people think about is a helical structure. That's what's inside of the helix of a traveling wave tube. There's the equivalent of that inside of a klystron amplifier, and a helical antenna has this characteristic. The actual radio signal traveling down that wire is moving at close to the speed of light on the wire up the helix.
1230.
However, the helix, because it has a certain pitch to it, and therefore how fast you advance forward on each turn is a function of that pitch. You take the sine of the angle of the pitch of the helix, and that tells you the velocity factor, because the signal traveling on the wire itself is close to the speed of light, a little bit slower than the speed of light. But because of the pitch of the helix, of either a helix antenna or the helix of a traveling wave tube, that pitch can give you a velocity factor down the center of the helix that is 50%, 40%, 30%. You can have all kinds of slow wave structures there compared to the speed of light because of the pitch angle. And that's required inside of a traveling wave tube because the way the traveling wave tube works is that your very well-focused beam of electrons, your very well-focused beam of electrons that go down the center of the tube would only move at the speed of light if you had an infinite voltage for them to be accelerated through, which of course you can't have for a whole bunch of reasons. So your beam has some velocity that is a lot slower than the speed of light. The signal going down the helix, if the signal going down the helix is matched in speed to the signal of the electric. photon beam, then one will couple into the other. Going down the helix has a kind of coupling. It's got a kind of coupling to the beam, and so the portions of the signal that are positively charged are accelerating the beam, and the portions of the signal that are negatively charged are decelerating the beam, so you're getting velocity modulation of portions of the beam. And therefore, after a certain drift space down the center of the wave tube, eventually the electron beam forms into bundles of electrons. Those bundles